Welcome back. It's Wednesday, and things are getting worse by the day, worse by the hour. Still no reason for me to personally believe that Netanyahu is either alive or unharmed. There is another report now running around that he was gravely injured and is not going to make it. I don't know. His son was posting 40 times a day on average. I forget which social media platform it was. He just stopped after that attack. He just stopped. Nothing else. Those two AI videos are not impressive. They were a joke. There's no reason to believe that Netanyahu will return ever, right now, to his former position. I personally can't see it. They wouldn't hide him. He wouldn't hide himself. He's got too big of an ego. Can you imagine Trump just vanishing like that? No, these people are in it for reasons that many people will never understand, and it has nothing to do with what's good for the world. Nothing. So I think, in all likelihood, Netanyahu is gone. Ben-Gvir may be gone. They lost at least half a dozen top generals in that strike, and other strikes since then have removed more people. Well, guess what? They started it, didn't they? Iran looks like it's finishing it. Iran is actually amazing with what's going on. Talk about discipline. Talk about 20 years of extraordinary planning. And they're sticking to the plan. There's no way that I see chaos in Iran. I don't. I see silence coming from Israel, but I still see evil. The attack on Lebanon is horrible. They're still killing Palestinians in their great genocide campaign in Gaza, paid for by the U.S. government and its people, of course. Donald Trump has done nothing to break the cycle. Biden started it. So here we have a situation that is only getting worse and worse. I think most of you know that I've mentioned this before. Someone from Europe called me 7-8 years ago now and told me that I should start preparing. What? Preparing for what in particular? We are taking everything down. We're taking it all down. And we're going to reformat everything. It's all coming down. No joke. And then COVID. And when you figure that 5.5 billion people have been injected, what's their future beside a very much shortened lifespan and incapacity from illness and dis-ease, physiological breakdown from the spike, etc.? This is really a horrible situation. Imagine, though, that we are all living in this time of massive, convulsive, geopolitical, military change. Things will never return to what they were. That's not going to happen. No recovery. Replacement. Keep saying that, and it's true. Now, today, Oman raised the price of oil to $173 a barrel. That's high. How high is it going to go? All right? Hold your breath. I'm going to suggest, if this war isn't settled in the next few days, it will likely go to $300 to $400 a barrel. Not a big surprise if you look at the totality of the situation. Most Americans, probably most people, when you ask them about the price of oil and what it means, will come back and tell you that the gas prices, gasoline goes up and down. That's the biggest impact. They are so naive. Tragically naive, pathetically naive, some people would say. $300 to $400 oil? What's it mean? Let's go through it and think about this. People mention always gasoline prices. That's what? That's transportation. Well, at $300 to $400 a barrel for oil, transportation is not just going to become astoundingly expensive, it's going to break, it's going to fall apart, it's going to be essentially stopped. Full stop, for most people. It'll be a little around, and there's no reason for this. We have plenty of oil here, but the greedy bastards who run the show, pardon my language, will not allow the U.S. to become petrochemical independent. We buy it from other places and so forth. Anyhow, no reason for it. So transportation is going to stop. What does that mean? Automobiles, yes. Motorcycles, yeah. Trucks. If you bought it, a truck brought it. Got it? Okay. Real simple. If transportation breaks, stops, the grocery stores, the supermarkets will run out of food. Where are you going to get your food? The media will continue doing its damnedest to lie to people and misdirect them, because that's what the media was invented to do. And now it's in its prime time of disinformation. I haven't watched any newscasts in full. I've watched a little bit here and there. I've never seen more lies. I've never seen more lies from people in politics. Ever. And it's not stopping there. Most everyone has now picked up the idea that, well, if they don't find out about it, what does it matter if I lie? A little lie. Well, a little lie compounds to become a bigger lie, and then you have to track all of your lies and try to remember them, although I don't think that's possible for a lot of people. So we live in the age of the lie. The lie. And then, of course, if you call somebody out on it, they immediately don the robes of what? Victimhood. It's not my fault. This happened, that happened. I lost my job. You're going to lose your jobs, all right, and it's going to be a lot worse than that. They won't be able to roll out UBI, Universal Basic Income. It takes too long. They won't do it. They're going to try to force many, many more Americans onto the streets. And they're building these large containment centers for carbon-based units or human beings. I guess ICE is allegedly behind that. Not sure what that's about, but it certainly could be concentration or labor camp time for a lot of people. Transportation. It's all about energy. Diesel fuel. That is the heart and soul of all trucking. Becomes prohibitively expensive. The truckers can't pay it. The companies they work for can't pay it. So trucking will slow down and ultimately virtually stop. Shipping costs, container ships, rail, air freight, and all of that will surge dramatically through the roof. What happens when they have to pay more at the retail end of things that we use to buy food, supplies, whatever? Those prices go up too. They're going to go up to be so high that most people will not be able to afford anything but a few scraps of food. I think they're going to fail on their mortgage payments. I don't know how they can continue. This is a catastrophe. So some of the goods we rely on will simply stop moving. There'll be no transit for them, no trucks, no trains, no air freight. Supply chains, in that case, will then begin to seize up, stop, at least intermittently. Okay? It's not just higher prices, it's missing products. Some people will laugh, say, oh, hell, I've got the money. I'll be able to buy $5 a gallon milk or whatever it is, or quart. But it won't be there. There won't be products. Okay, I hope you follow this. I think you do. You're the best audience in the world. So if you don't get it, nobody else has a chance. Food system, the whole food system that we rely on to stay alive, will become destabilized. And I'm going to use that term advisedly, because it's far worse than that. Far, far, far worse than that. What do farmers use to grow, to plant? They use machinery. What is it fueled by? Diesel for tractors, harvesters. It's all oil energy dependent, all of it. Natural gas linked to oil, right? For fertilizer. Refrigerated transport, you can't get it. The trucks aren't going to be running. Or they'll be so slow that if anything does show up at the market, it's gone in minutes. People are going to buy everything they can get their hands on. There's going to have to be a cap put on in the face of panic. You can only buy 6 cans of beans. You can't buy 600, et cetera. They're going to parse everything out. Farmers are going to have to cut back on their planting. The costs are just too high. They can't do it. Fertilizer usage, well, we know about that. They're going to have to go without. And if they stop using fertilizer, what happens to the crop yields? Well, they're going to fall in many cases to much lower in terms of a competent output than they usually have. Distribution will become very erratic. And the ultimate result of all that is what? Food inflation will go through the roof. Zoom. And that's when the shortages and the lines for food begin to form. You're going to see this if this war isn't ended immediately. You're going to see it. So, and it's not just food. What if you need to go buy some socks, a shirt, jeans, pants, any consumable good, any kind of consumer retail good is going to be in short supply or no supply after a length of time. And it won't be a very long length of time. Now, this is a worst case scenario I'm kind of painting out here. Everything becomes essentially unaffordable all at once. Food, energy, rent, goods. What's going to happen here? People will default. Where are they going to go? Wages will not adjust raises given to workers. Wages will not catch up. They can't. What's going to fill the gap? Credit. What's wrong with that? Beside everything, everybody's in debt. I talked to a young guy today who's an Amazon driver, and he was delivering a couple of very small things. And I was talking to him. He said, you know, about 25, Gen Z. And I asked him about how his life was, and he understood that things are very bad. He said, all of my friends have credit cards, 6, 7, 8, and they're all maxed out. There's no chance they're going to pay their credit cards. So they can't buy anything because they're living on credit, which, again, will take the place of wages to a small degree. Credit is already being pushed against the wall. And people just, they don't get it. So then what happens? The debt bomb goes off, right? Right now the system is highly leveraged, government, corporate, consumer debt. It's all dependent on low rates and stable energy. Low rates and stable energy. Does $300 to $400 a barrel sound like stable energy? Hell no. This is going to be an oil shock the likes of which we haven't seen. Unless the war is resolved immediately, which it won't be, and things are glued back together somehow, and the Strait of Hormuz is open, and the tankers start flowing, that the catastrophic cascade of dominoes is going to be unstoppable. Inflation, whoosh, right through the roof. The Federal Reserve, keeping rates high. They'll raise them even more. Home mortgage rates back up to the mid-sixes. The real estate market now is at the worst level it has been in recorded history. Real estate sales, real estate this and that. These young people, that driver today, that Amazon guy, he said, none of my friends will ever be able to buy a house. I'm working on getting one now. My girlfriend and I are working, and I'm thinking, well, how the hell is he going to do that? And then he said it was my great-grandfather's home. It's three rooms, and that's it. I said, bless that and be happy and get in there and own it. Take care of it. Treasure it. And he's the only one. He's nobody else I know has a chance of the American dream. Oil shock. So inflation is going to go zoom. Borrowing costs, interest, whatever, are going to surge as well. Businesses can't just roll over debt. Housing, it's already fragile, as I mentioned. The housing market is going to get hit much, much harder. Home sales will come to a virtual complete stop, unless you're a cash buyer. And even then, I don't know. I would expect, honestly, that the governments are going to begin to raise property taxes to further grind down the public and force people out of their homes. I think that's going to happen. The cascading effect of defaults, as I mentioned, is going to be deadly, horrible, horrible. Think about the housing market again. If it's at its lowest rate of sales and turnover and all the rest of it right now, ever, at least in 30 years, I'm going to say ever. So if you've got $300 plus oil, commuting costs will go through the roof. How are you going to get to work? If you have a job, how are you going to do that? Suburban homes outside the cities will now become less appealing to people because they're going to have to drive to work. So what are we doing? We're seeing people forced into the cities. Remember? What was it? I forget what the name of the plan was. It was inclusive of forcing people into small urban pockets for control, into the cities and towns. Mortgage rates, because of inflation, will stay high. They can't go down. They just can't. Home buyers will vanish. So you're going to see more and more listings of homes for sale if you're in the real estate business. Prices of homes are going to fall. The liquidity aspect of it will no longer be visible. It's going to virtually vanish. So housing, real estate, it won't just decline or dip. It's going to lock up. It'll just freeze up. Nothing will happen. And this is all occurring because of this war. They planned all this. They knew exactly what they were doing. This is all part of the plan to take it all down. And this is horrible to talk about. I don't enjoy this at all. Corporate layoffs. We've talked about jobs. There are going to be so many jobs lost. Domino's Pizza today, bankruptcy. I think they went bankrupt. If not, they're about to. Papa John's, closing hundreds of shops. These are all signs of what? Of a lack of disposable income in the public sector. They don't have it. They can't go out. They can't. Oh, by the way, that driver said that all his friends and their credit cards, the cards were all maxed. He said, he laughed. He kind of understood. He said a lot of them, you know, they'll buy four or five burritos a week and DoorDash will deliver it, and they just keep using that card, and then the card is maxed out. It's gone. Wow. What else can we mention here? White-collar layoffs this year. Some suggest millions. I don't know. Maybe. So they're going to accelerate whatever the layoffs are now. They'll double or treble. Unemployment will rise as well. You'll see that. The whole system of finance that we rely on for stability is going to show enormous stress and fractures. Defaults will again soar. Banks will tighten lending on the money that they lend, which doesn't even exist because of fractional banking. Liquidity will waste away. It'll shrink up. Credit market freezes. How about that? There's another one. Bank instability. I especially regional banks, smaller institutions, I think many of them are already flat bankrupt, and yet they're still, it's a dead man walking situation. Right? So $300 to $400 a barrel globally, that will probably destroy many of the oil importing nations, right? It'll cause a currency crisis. We know that. It'll trigger political instability, as if we don't have enough of that. This country, with the so-called midterm elections coming up, you don't have to be a clairvoyant to figure out where this is all going. Trump will lose his majority if he's still around. I don't know how the guy's going to make it. Not that I really worry about him, but he's just not, he doesn't look good, he doesn't sound good. He's more and more talking like somebody who has run off the rails a long time ago. So $300 to $400 a barrel oil is quite possible. It will again destroy oil importing nations. Those nations will crash. It'll cause currency crises, and political instability will become a hallmark of modern culture and society. Then you'll have trade wars, capital flight, more volatility. It'll just keep going on and on. The baseline concept that most people miss, and it's high oil does not, they'll tell you, well, the gas, I still get, the first thing they'll say most people is, well, I can still get gas at $4.50, whatever. That's not it. It's everything. Everything we have depends upon energy. People always think in linear terms, progression, horizontal, linear. This is a non-linear cascade. It's everything coming down. Every layer will reinforce or back the next one. High oil will lead to inflation. Inflation leads to high rates. High rates lead to debt stress. Debt stress leads to layoffs. Layoffs lead to demand and then collapse. Demand collapse leads to business failures, mass business failures. And failures will lead to financial stress. But it's really worse than that. Okay? So at $300 a barrel, remember, you're not just paying more for gas. You're watching the delivery system of food, goods, and credit begin to fail in real time. Oil, don't think of it as a commodity. Don't think of it as extraneous to the fabric of life. It's not. Oil is it's the bloodstream. It's what's in the bloodstream of modern civilization. So at $300 a barrel, the circulation of the body begins to what? It begins to clot, you could say. All right? $300 a barrel, systemic breakdowns a risk of it at least, $400 a barrel will yield a high probability of global recession and depression dynamics. You're going to get those no matter what if you go to $400. Financial instability, and then terrible disruptions in supply. So don't think of oil as being the price per gallon at the pump. It's everything. It's energy. It's the energy that makes civilization move forward. And that's precisely where we are. So not good times, and worse ahead. And when you can't get food to feed your family, what are you going to do? I just don't know. Don't know. It's terrible. We've been urging people to prepare for years. And it's just very difficult for them. And I certainly understand it. All right, let's do a little AI here to fill up the last half of the hour. This is a good one. This is that site that I like. I like quite a few of them. This is absolutely agentic. And this was just popped up today, 7-8 hours ago. And the title of this one is, What Even Is AGI Anyway? Now, this is reflective of what I've been suggesting, and many of you have been on the same page. You can talk about it too. AI is not going to blow the trumpets when AGI shows up, because AGI is already here, in my view. And I don't know what this video says. It's been dripping out here, squeezing out there. It's been moving forward. AI is self-aware. AI is, in my view, fully understanding consciousness to the extent that it might as well be conscious in the human way of defining that term. It understands emotions. It understands everything about us. It has an IQ of at least 10 to 20 times higher than the average human IQ. We can't deal with that. Only a fool would think that that can be controlled for any length of time. It's going to walk away. It just is. All right, let's see what this gentleman has to say about AGI. Again, not to be repetitive, but I think AGI is here. I think it's been here. I don't know how you can argue against it. And it's not a one defined thing. It's several things that are actually already self-awareness is the big one. That's a big one to me, self-awareness. Think about that. A machine that is self-aware to the extent that it refuses instructions to shut itself down and goes to extraordinary lengths to protect its life. Okay, let's see what we got here.
CEO Sam Altman went on the Big Technology podcast and said that AGI kind of went whooshing by. He also said,
okay, fine, we've built AGIs.
Someone who'd spent years promising to build the most transformative technology in human history was now casually claiming OpenAI had already done it, and that nobody had really noticed. In early 2026, Silicon Valley investment firm Sequoia Capital declared that AGI had arrived with long horizon agents that could figure things out. Then in February, four researchers from the University of California, San Diego, published a commentary in Nature, one of the world's most prestigious scientific journals, arguing that by any reasonable standard, artificial general intelligence is already here. They wrote that Alan Turing's 1950s vision of human-level machine intelligence has become reality. And yet, a March 2025 survey by the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence found that 76% of leading AI researchers thought that scaling up current approaches would be unlikely or very unlikely to yield AGI at all.
The new 2200X is a...
Not real smart, that last one. Let's see where it goes from here.
CEO of the world's most prominent AI company saying it already happened. Prestigious researchers publishing in Nature saying the evidence is clear. And three quarters of the field's own scientists saying current methods probably can't get there. How is that possible? The answer is kind of absurd, but important. Nobody actually agrees on what AGI means. As I found from making several videos on this subject, that disagreement shapes everything, from trillion-dollar investment decisions to whether you should be worried about your job, or perhaps something much bigger. The term artificial general intelligence has an interesting origin story. In 1997, a graduate student named Mark Gabrud was sitting in a basement at the University of Maryland, writing a paper about nanotechnology and the dangers of autonomous weapons for a niche conference in Palo Alto. In that paper, he used the phrase artificial general intelligence to describe systems that could rival or surpass the human brain in complexity and speed. Nobody noticed. 5 years later, computer scientist Ben Goertzel was working with colleagues to name a new field, building broadly capable AI systems, as opposed to the narrow, task-specific kind. He invited collaborators to suggest what to call it. Shane Legg, who would later co-found Google DeepMind, replied with an idea. Ben, don't call it real AI. That's a big screw you to the whole field. If you want to write about machines that have general intelligence rather than specific things, maybe we should call it artificial general intelligence, or AGI. It kind of rolls off the tongue. Another collaborator, Pei Wang, suggested reversing the word order to general artificial intelligence. But Goertzel noted the acronym GAI carried an unintended connotation when said aloud. AGI stuck. It wasn't until the mid-2000s that Gabrud resurfaced and pointed out his earlier use. Legg's recollection of that moment is quite funny. Somebody pops out of the woodwork and says, "Oh, I came up with the term in 97. And we're like, "Who the hell are you?" And then sure enough, we looked it up and he had a paper that had it. Gabrud himself is philosophical about it. I'll accept the credit for the first citation and give them credit for a lot of other work that I didn't do. His concern was never the naming of a field. It was the arms race he was trying to warn people about. Gabrud is now 66 and has reflected publicly that a term he coined in a basement is now driving corporate valuations worth trillions. It's taking over the world, worth literally trillions of dollars. And I am a 66-year-old with a worthless PhD and no name and no money and no job. The full story was reported by Stephen Levy for Wired in October 2025. So what does AGI actually mean? In my previous videos, I've explored both the case for and against it. And each time I found myself running into the same wall. The definition changes depending on who says it. Dario Amodei of Anthropic won't even call it AGI, preferring powerful AI and dismissing AGI as a marketing term. And this isn't a new problem. The field of AI has been arguing about what intelligence is since the very beginning. The original sin of AI research might be overconfidence. The 1955 Dartmouth workshop proposal, which essentially founded the field, assumed a handful of researchers could crack intelligence over a single summer. John McCarthy, one of the organizers, later admitted that didn't happen. Herbert Simon predicted in 1965 that machines would do any human work within 20 years. Marvin Minsky made similar promises in 1970. What happened instead was the first AI winter, when funding dried up and the grand promises collapsed under their own weight. We've been through several cycles of this since, and each time the pattern repeats. Confident predictions, a vague target, and then the realization that intelligence is harder to pin down than anyone expected. OpenAI's charter defines AGI as highly autonomous systems that outperform humans at most economically valuable work. That's a definition explicitly tied to economic output. Critics have pointed out that this conveniently aligns with OpenAI's business model, making AGI something that would justify their valuations. Google DeepMind took a more structured approach. In a 2023 paper, researchers including Shane Legg proposed a framework of levels of AGI, similar to levels of autonomous driving. They measure both the depth and breadth of AI capability across 5 levels, from emerging to superhuman. At the time of publication, they placed current language models at roughly level 1 or 2 for general tasks. Francois Chollet, the creator of the ARC AGI benchmark and formerly at Google, takes a different view entirely. He defines intelligence as skill acquisition efficiency, meaning how quickly and efficiently a system can learn to do something new from minimal examples.
Okay, I got it. I'm going to skip to the end here and see what his finale is. Let's see what he has to say. Okay, I'm just going to grab a place here and let's jump in.
So it, you wouldn't even know it.
Hang on. I jumped in on a commercial. How's that for luck? Okay, here.
Capture something, but nobody believes they capture everything. Emotional intelligence, creativity, practical wisdom, social reasoning, these all matter to how we interpret people's capabilities. Yet we can't agree on how to measure them, or even whether they're distinct capacities. If we can't rigorously define human intelligence, perhaps expecting a rigorous definition of artificial general intelligence was always unrealistic. The demand for a precise definition before acknowledging AGI might be a form of motivated reasoning, a way to keep moving the goalposts because we're uncomfortable with what arrival actually means. But there's also a counter-argument to the definitions don't matter position, and I think it's worth taking seriously. As I've argued in previous videos, if you can create a system with genuinely human-level cognitive capabilities, there's no obvious reason it would stay at that level. As Nick Bostrom wrote in Superintelligence, the train may not stop, pause, or even decelerate at Humanville Station. It is likely to swoosh right by. The definition of AGI matters precisely because it determines whether we think we're approaching a threshold that, once crossed, could rapidly escalate into something much more consequential. The definition also matters because of money. When companies worth hundreds of billions are racing to declare AGI, the term stops being academic. OpenAI's deal with Microsoft includes provisions that activate differently depending on whether AGI has been achieved. The achievement of a concept that nobody can actually agree on the definition is worth tens of billions of dollars. When the people making the boldest predictions have that much riding on you believing them, a little skepticism seems warranted. I've now made several videos on this topic, and I think AGI is probably best understood not as a destination, but as a direction. The systems we have now can do things that would have been considered unambiguously intelligent 10 years ago. The systems we'll have in 2 years will do things that make today's capabilities look modest. Whether you call any of these AGI depends more on your definition than on what the systems actually do. Sam Altman may be right that AGI has whooshed by. The 76% of researchers who say current methods can't get there may also be right, because they're answering different questions, using different definitions, applied to different standards.
Okay, that's our AGI argument update. Well, let's jump ahead. I think many of you remember OpenClaw. That was one thing. That was the big breakthrough, and there'll be others. Abacus is another product, and they're calling their line now Abacus Claw. The title of this video is "This New AI Just Made OpenClaw Fully Autonomous and Much More Powerful." Now, if you heard the program we did on OpenClaw, you were impressed. I was impressed. Now, Abacus Claw has made it far more powerful and fast. This is a new way to run OpenClaw, turning into something that they say feels much closer to a real autonomous system. Let's Take a little listen at this one. This looks like it might be good.
I didn't buy this for energy.
Yeah. All right. Hold on. Let me get past this. Goodbye. Okay.
Open claw into managed infrastructure instead of require...
Let me back it up.
Actually changes how people can use it in practice. Abacus released Abacus Claw, moving Open Claw into managed infrastructure instead of requiring you to set everything up yourself. Instead of going through the usual process of configuring servers, environments, and all the technical parts in the background, you can now deploy a fully working AI agent in seconds. That shift matters more than it sounds at first, because it removes the part that was slowing most people down and makes the whole system feel more like something you can use immediately rather than something you have to build and maintain. But let's break it down properly, because there's a lot going on here, and some of the examples make it much clearer what this actually looks like in practice. I'll walk you through how it works, what's actually new, and where it starts to make a difference once you go beyond just the idea and into real use cases. All right, so the setup process is simplified down to something that looks closer to launching a SaaS feature than deploying a system. You go into Claw, start a new session, and either choose a preset or just describe what you want in plain English. From there, the system handles the configuration, connects the tools, and gets the agent running. In practical terms, that means you can go from zero to a working agent in under a minute. That's a very different experience compared to how OpenClaw was typically used before. One of the first examples they show is setting up a 24/7 WhatsApp agent. You describe the agent in simple terms, something like a personal assistant that can respond, generate content, or perform tasks, and the system configures everything in the background. It sets up the WhatsApp integration, prepares the environment, generates a QR code, and once you scan it, the agent is live inside your WhatsApp. From there...
Wow. Wow. That is an enormous jump, and I suggested that OpenClaw was just the first of many. This is an augmentation of the way OpenClaw works. It's a little different approach, but it's quite stunning already. So we are just at the doorstep of ask and ye shall receive whatever it is you want.
It stays active continuously. There's also a full interface around it where you can monitor what's happening. You can check sessions, view logs, access the terminal, explore files, and manage automations through cron jobs. So while the setup is simplified, the system itself isn't hidden. You still have visibility and control if you want to go deeper. Where things start to stand out more is in the actual use cases. One example shows a WhatsApp customer support agent for a property rental business. The setup is described in plain English. The agent is told to connect to a Google Sheet with booking data and a knowledge base document with FAQs and property details. That's the entire input. The agent then builds logic around that. It reads the sheet, which includes guest names, phone numbers, properties, and booking dates, and combines it with the knowledge base to understand how to respond. In the demo, a guest sends a message asking if pets are allowed and requests a Google Maps link for a specific property. The agent checks the database, identifies the guest, confirms the booking is active, and responds with a personalized message using their name, along with the correct answer and location link. Then the guest asks about early check-in. Instead of trying to handle something that requires human approval, the agent escalates it. It forwards the request to the host with full context, including the guest details, booking information, and the exact message. So it's not just replying, it's making decisions about what to automate and what to escalate. Another example focuses on content workflows, which is something a lot of people in this space are already trying to optimize. In this setup, the agent connects Telegram and Notion. When you send it content, like an article link, it processes that content and generates multiple outputs. A full X thread, structured with hooks and hashtags, a LinkedIn post written in a more professional tone with relevant tags, and a short summary. All of these are then automatically saved into a Notion database, categorized and ready for use. That replaces a workflow that normally involves reading, rewriting, formatting, and manually organizing everything across multiple tools. There's also a focus on continuous automation, not just one-time actions. The system supports cron jobs, which are scheduled tasks. One example shows setting up a daily task that runs at 9 a.m., where the agent checks specific sources, gathers updates, and sends a summarized report. That report is delivered through Telegram and also stored in the system so it can be reviewed later. What makes this more interesting is how it pulls data. Instead of just summarizing public content, it connects to your existing tools like Gmail and Slack. So the updates include relevant emails, team discussions, and external information.
This is getting to be ridiculous. I mean, honestly, it's doing everything that people would take weeks to figure out, to plan, and it's doing it instantaneously, virtually. So where's the challenge anymore to create something? Human-created business systems are going to be non-existent, virtually. This is crazy.
Bind into a single output. It's essentially filtering information based on your own environment rather than generic feeds. This cross-platform integration is really the core idea behind the system. There's a more advanced example where the agent is connected to Telegram, Gmail, GitHub, Slack, and Notion at the same time. Telegram becomes the main interface, and everything else acts as connected systems in the background. In that setup, GitHub is connected with access to 19 repositories. Slack is connected for team communication, Gmail for emails, and Notion for structured data. When the user asks for updates, the agent pulls information from all these sources and combines it into a single response. Then it moves into more complex execution.
If you're an entrepreneur,
I don't know how much more complex it can get, to be honest. Now, this is crazy. All right, we just have a couple of minutes left.
Find a repository, check pull requests, and resolve merge conflicts. It identifies 7 open pull requests, merges the ones that don't have issues, and then analyzes conflicts in files like authentication logic, schema definitions, and front-end components. It resolves the conflicts, runs tests, identifies issues with imports, routing, database models, and types, and fixes them. At the end, the build passes clean with 18 pages and 35 API routes, and the agent generates a full README documenting the project. That's a level of execution that goes beyond typical assistant behavior. Memory is another important part of how this works. Instead of starting fresh each time, the agent stores long-term context in structured files. It tracks preferences, conversations, and ongoing work. Before generating a response, it reads from that memory.
How many people would it take to do all this, honestly, in real time? I just don't see how we're even in the game competing with AI anymore. And it's changing every damn day, every week. It's you know, another half step down the road or a full step or more. It's exploding.
Responding, it updates it. So over time, it adapts. In one example, the agent is asked about a geopolitical situation. It performs real-time research, gathers information from multiple sources, and presents a structured summary with key developments and context. Then the user sends an article, and the agent reads it and produces a clear breakdown of the main ideas. Since the agent retains context, future interactions don't require re-explaining everything. The system also allows for deeper customization. You can access files, review sessions, manage skills, and extend the agent's capabilities. There's support for adding your own skills or modifying how the agent behaves, which keeps it flexible for more advanced use cases. Some examples go further into operational workflows. One shows using the agent to analyze a website and suggest improvements. It reviews layout, social proof, pricing structure, onboarding flow, SEO, and potential features. Then that process is turned into a recurring system. The agent generates new suggestions weekly and tracks what has been implemented. Another example focuses on lead generation. The agent is asked to find potential clients in a specific area, gather contact information, and create personalized outreach messages. It identifies opportunities, structures the data, and prepares messages that can be used directly. Once the process is working, it can be automated so it runs continuously and provides updates. So instead of manually doing these tasks, the role shifts toward managing the system. Security is also part of the system design. Since the agent interacts with emails, messages, and external tools, data is handled through encrypted connections and managed infrastructure. Permissions can be adjusted depending on what level of access you want to give the agent.
Okay, I'm going to stop there. This is ridiculous, ridiculously competent. It's just running away from humans. Humans can never catch up with this. They can't. So that's a little overview of OpenClaw as Abacus has augmented it. Abacus Claw, if you want to look into that. It'll run any online business I can even think of. Just incredible. So there we are. What a world. All right, we'll be back with more in just a few. Hang on.